Oh, don't worry. You got the right show. It's Depresh Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. We're just giving our regular opening music a bit of a break, just for this week. You've been hearing the song Buddy by Tim Heidecker.
Nothing. Nothing ever went your way. You told me that things would be better someday.
Tim Heidecker might be best known as one of the stars, along with his collaborator Eric Wareheim, of Tim and Eric Awesome Show Great Job, a kind of surrealist sketch comedy show that ran for 5 seasons on Adult Swim. Tim has acted in movies like Ant-Man and the Wasp, Bridesmaids, and the Jordan Peele film Us. He performs stand-up, playing a kind of toxic masculinity bro comedian who's just a complete asshole. Tim also co-hosts the podcast series On Cinema, playing a guy named Tim who reviews movies but doesn't really like movies. Tim Heidecker is very funny. And then there's Tim's music, which is often not so funny at all. He's put out a few albums now of sincere singer-songwriter music where he is very much in touch with what sure sounds like depression to me, like major depressive disorder, clinical stuff. But Tim has never been diagnosed with depression. And I've always been interested in that situation with some creative people. Is it a case where the artist just hasn't received a diagnosis for something that they clearly have? Or are they doing fine and yet are capable of creating around that idea of depression? Tim's new album is called High School. It contains songs about high school, his high school experience. And depression is just all over this album. I asked Tim why he keeps coming back to a kind of bleakness of the soul.
That might be my self-help or my self-care side of it, where I explore those thoughts. I have an outlet for them. They're cathartic. I, you know, don't over-obsess or dwell on them, but they do make good material. It does make good material. It's reflective to think of. I mean, a very literal example might be the song Fear of Death, which, you know,
it's right there in the title.
Yeah. Oh, it also has lines like, you know, I don't see the value in having fun. I don't want to leave the house again. I don't count on us becoming friends. I've learned all I can learn. I think I'm done growing. Like, I think those thoughts pass through my, as I sort of reflect on things or I feel that way for a period of time, I can write about it, explore it, and then I can maybe not obsess about it quite as much that maybe some other people, that is all they can think about. And there is, I mean, I do have a love of sad songs or of kind of dark subject matter because I don't know, I don't want to sing shiny, happy people, you know, like I don't, that's not a fun experience. So I think I lean that way just like taste wise, but you know, I do have a fairly dark outlook, I suppose. I try not to let it overwhelm me or, you know, grind me down.
You're more like Peter Buck in the video for Shiny Happy People, where he's just gritting his teeth and trying to get through it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I noticed too on, I think it was on the last album, you have a song called When I Get Up, which is really just
about
wanting to go right back to bed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're right. It's all there. And to me, I think there's something clever about that idea, or I think maybe I'm wrong. I would be happy to find out otherwise, but I feel like there's a healthy place where you can feel those thoughts or you can have those thoughts and have that feeling and then, you know, go have lunch and feel better in the afternoon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because when you talk about kind of feeling these things, putting them into a song, putting them into, you know, any of the other creative outlets that you have, that you have as part of your job, it kind of goes along with the notion behind cognitive behavioral therapy. I don't know if you know what that is.
Not really, no.
It's a complicated thing, and I don't want to oversimplify it, but a big part of it is an understanding of, okay, what you feel and how you emotionally respond to that is somewhat beyond your control. Like something is happening in the world, you're going to feel it. Mm-hmm. You do have control over the actions that you take afterwards. Like you have a moment of consciousness where you say, oh, I'm really furious about this. I'm going to write a poem. I'm going to punch a wall. I'm going to scream. I'm going to fall over.
Right.
You get to decide. But right. A big part of that is like when you feel the thing, you kind of hold it in your hand and you kind of recognize, oh, this is what this is doing to me.
Right.
What can I learn from this? And it seems like that's a step that you've sort of arrived at through the music. It's like you see some darkness and then you hold it in your hand and you examine it.
Yeah. I mean, for sure. And I can think of a million examples. There's another song on the new record called I've Been Losing.
Yeah.
And it's just about this feeling of, and it has to do with mostly it starts probably from a core feeling of, you know, a show I made didn't get picked up, you know, like a thing I've done isn't really working that well, or a show we're pitching doesn't get picked up or like they pass on it. That feeling is losing. I've lost. I'm trying to win and I lose.
Yeah.
And that's how I'm feeling right now. And so what's a good way for me to handle that? Sit at the piano and sing about it and hit record and find a melody that makes me happy, or find a chord progression that I find interesting, and then get to work on making that as good as I can make it.
There's a few songs on the album that I kind of copy and pasted some of the lyrics into my notes. That was one of them. Uh-huh. And like when I looked at a lot of these lyrics, it occurs to me that these almost just read as journal entries or essays. They just happen to be lyrics to songs. And a lot of times they don't rhyme. You know, I've been working myself up to the fact that my best days are behind me and the road up ahead will be filled with looking back. Will I look back with regret of moments to forget, or will I love what I see and the memories will surround me? Like it doesn't.
That's pretty good.
It's not sing-songy really at all. It's like, right. Oh shit, he's really laying stuff down here.
Yeah. But that's pretty good though. I mean, I do have regret and forget in there. So there's a technical rhyme.
But you don't have June and Moon or Dance and Romance. So I think
right,
you're okay.
No, I mean, listen, I make music, or the music I make is very, the lyrics are a big part of it. And I want to get things out of my head and want to express myself that in a different way than my comedy. And I think there's a communal aspect to it where there's people that connect with it because they feel the same way. You know, that's where we have common ground. And I think through that, I hope, and this is a good safe place to be fairly pretentious.
yes, please.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully that's a positive. The shared experience makes that person feel better or feel more connected. And a lot of people have a hard time feeling connected. And I've just heard it from people, like with my last record. I know the subject matter is dark, but it was very heartwarming to me, or it felt very therapeutic to me, because I've had those thoughts. And if you've had those thoughts, it makes me feel less alone to know that there's people out there that feel the same way.
Well, there's brain science behind that too, that people respond to, they say, and I don't know how exact this is, but if you're feeling sad, listening to sad music will help, because it's not going to intensify your feelings, because the feelings are already there. Your emotional life is already there, but you'll feel recognized. You'll feel like, oh, I'm not alone in going through this. I have other fellow travelers on this journey.
Yes, yes. And I don't say I do that. I don't say it's why I do that. I do things like this, and almost everything I do is kind of for myself, or it's just my form of self-expression. But it's a nice residual effect, I think, and I'm happy. It's always nice to hear that.
I'm interested in the memories that you have from childhood that tie into the song Sirens of Titan. Mm-hmm. You talk about Peter. It's not often in music that you hear Peter Arnett name dropped.
I think it's a first time, I would guess.
Certainly doesn't happen in a lot of contemporary hip-hop, I believe. Peter Arnett was a CNN correspondent in the first Gulf War, and you talk about in a Baghdad hotel and the bombs and the threats to Israel. It sounds like that's a very specific set of memories that you have.
Very much so, and can't say exactly how. I would have been in eighth grade or something like that, 12, 13. And it was the first time cable news was sort of on the ground during the beginning of a military operation, the beginning of a war. And it just felt like a very big moment for America, for televised news. I remember it being like, that was the next day. It was like, wow, did you see CNN last night? It was like, you could see the bombs. Like, they were live. They were hiding in this hotel. And Bernard Shaw was the other one, but right. Doesn't sound as good. I just like the rhythmic of Peter Arnett. You know, I just like, it's a very Dylan-y kind of language.
Right. Something I noticed about the music, and I've seen you comment on it too, that there's a sort of 70s singer-songwriter vibe to the music that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Was that intentional? Did you say, I want to sound like that, or did it just show up that way?
I think it starts with I think this record is a little departure from that because there's a lot of drum machines and synths on it, which isn't found a lot in the 70s singer-songwriter.
Right.
World, but yeah, I mean, I'm a fairly simple player. My chords and structures of my songs are fairly limited to 4 to 5 chords, you know. And I love that kind of music. I don't really want to expand beyond that. That's the arrangement style. Except in this new record, I think it goes a little to a different place. But yeah, I don't know. I guess it's the kind of music I write, and you kind of want to see it through to be the best it can be in the style that it's being written in. So there you go.
Yeah. Does music give you a different voice, or does it kind of allow an expression of a different part of yourself than the comedy or the podcasting or any of the other work you do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a totally different... I mean, it's not a different part of my brain necessarily. The process is similar. The process of writing is a little different because it's a solo activity. It's personal and, like you said, more of a journal entry style of writing. But the execution of it is collaborative, and I work with some good, you know, talented friends who help me make it as good as it can be. But, you know, I think about 8 years ago, I started making a record called In Glendale, and that was the first record that was about my life in a way that was a little more literal and autobiographical than my comedy will ever be. So, and up to that point, I didn't feel like I had permission or I didn't have the legitimate life experience to really sing or write about anything worth listening to, you know? I'd gotten married and had a baby and had a house, and I was starting to write music about those experiences, and that felt kind of interesting to me. Here I am, and I'd just spent a decade building this persona with Eric and myself with various projects under my own name that were intentionally confusing and intentionally layered with irony and masks and things. And And not to sound like I was too strategic about it, but it was interesting to me that I was like, oh, I could actually now be myself, and that would be a new character.
You know? Right, right. Well, I mean, I remember when I first heard you put out music, I was like, okay, is this a bit or is this...
Yeah.
And has that been a hurdle for you to climb to convince people, no, this is... You could listen to this without... I'm not playing a character here.
Yeah, I mean, for a lot of people, it's a novelty that it isn't a bit, you know, and that's like that's the hook where they're like, oh, interesting. That's an interesting. I'm like, well,
everyone's waiting
for
the punchline to drop.
Yeah,
and it just never drops.
Yeah, I mean, I think people don't want to feel like they're being fooled, or they don't want to be the on the losing end of a prank, you know, so they're a little cautious about it. But you know, it's been a while now, and I think the fact that I'm working with legitimate musicians. And when I speak about it, I try not to be confusing about it. I try to be fairly honest about it. But yeah, there's still going to be, I mean, there's still people, I don't know if you saw this last week, there's still people out there. I mean, of course, and again, not to sound pretentious, there's massive lumps of people that don't know who I am, don't have any context for who I am. And one of my stand-up scenes from my stand-up special went up online and it got picked up by a whole group of people that just took it at face value as that I'm this terrible comedian. And
this is the stuff about the opera.
Yeah, the opera bit.
We'll hear that opera bit right after the break. Back with Tim Heidecker, let's play a clip from Tim's stand-up where he plays a comedian who is just an awful person. He talks about going to the opera with his wife. They're sitting down. The opera singer is singing.
Looking around. An hour goes by. I couldn't take it. I stood up. I go, shut the fuck up!
Well, I've been doing sort of a bad stand-up character, and I'm not the first person to have cracked into this mode of comedy, you know, but I've been doing this bad stand-up character, leather jacket, you know, club comedian, misogynistic, right-wing piece of shit that's not funny. And there's loads of those people working in, you know, at high levels in comedy right now. So, you know, it's not impossible that this guy would be a success. But I've been doing it for a while. And it started out kind of as a prank or sort of, you know, fucking with the audience. And then, you know, it became, as fans of mine found it, they just thought it was funny because they were in on the joke, you know, because they thought they were laughing at the character more than the material. So, you know, I did it for years and then we filmed it as a special, put it up online over the pandemic. And it looks, you know, if you look at it from across the room, it looks like any old Netflix stand-up special, you know?
Right, right.
But it's unhinged and the guy, my character is deeply, deeply unfunny and unpleasant. And I understand that. But the audience at the taping was my fans. So they were all for it. They were just laughing along. And I'm going on tour this summer, plug, and we're putting out clips from that special, as you do, to promote. And it just, the other day, it got just picked up in the weirdest way. I think it started with some right-wing, you know, patriot account who was like, Twitter's full of people being like, check this out, look how bad this is, or look how stupid this guy is, or look how somebody explained the joke to me, or something like that. And that spread just like wildfire, and it got picked up by every little segment. There was right-wing Twitter first was all over it saying, this guy, you know, I've seen funnier jokes, you know, in my mashed potatoes or something. You know, just like, just who could get the biggest joke about why this is so bad. And then it got picked up by left-wing Twitter. You had, you know, people saying that I'm a misogynist. This, like someone said, let's call this what it is, misogynistic violence. Because my bit was me going to the opera and because it's my wife's birthday and not liking the opera and yelling, shut the fuck up to the opera singer.
Right. Okay.
Like you can watch it and decide if it's funny as a, and then you'd have people saying, I know satire and this is not good satire because it's too close to the real thing and he should have, you know, like just a million opinions about why it's not funny.
But it's a broad consensus across all the entire spectrum that you suck and are terrible.
Yeah, from different different groups of people, different reasons why it doesn't work.
Right.
But, you know, those are just the people that are saying it. There's like, you know, thousands and thousands of people that just liked it and
sure
and have told me they liked it. And, you know, so I don't take it personally. And this might go back to like the mental health conversation. Like I find it fascinating from sort of like a sociological place that people are out there that feel entitled or safe to publicly announce their confusion about something. You know, I think that's an interesting phenomenon of social media that I would be personally, I don't know about you, but I would be kind of embarrassed to be waving a flag out there saying I'm confused or I don't understand something. You know, I can, those are valid feelings to be confused or not understand something, but I might not project it. I might
state that to the world.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, like, we've talked about kind of this darkness that you're cognizant of that certainly shows up in a lot of your music. And I think it shows up in a lot of your comedy. I think there's lot of darkness to, you know, Tim and Eric's show and a lot of the work you've done.
Yes.
And I used to be very doctrinaire about what a mental disorder is and isn't, what somebody with a disorder is and is not, that they need to be diagnosed by a clinician and there needs to be some sort of acronym around the condition that they have, and they have it and other people don't have it. And I've become more agnostic over the years of like, well, everybody's kind of just dealing with shit. And if it helps to say, okay, here's a set of symptoms that are commonly associated with this disorder, then you can use this disorder term for your insurance and help pay for some of the treatment that you get for it. Are you kind of along the same way of like, you know, maybe it's a disorder, maybe it's not. It's just some stuff that I'm dealing with?
For myself?
Yeah.
Yes. I think so. I think if things got to a place where people were telling me I should get help, maybe, or if I felt like I was suffering, my work was suffering, or I was not able to function in certain ways throughout the day, I would be well open to that. I just don't. I'm a little lazy in general, which people roll their eyes about that because there might be a perception that I'm not lazy because of the fact that I do a lot of things. But
yeah, that's what not being lazy means.
Yeah, well,
is that you do a lot of things.
I guess like when it comes to my own health and it comes like, you know, I'm a persistent back issues that I kind of just could be doing more to deal with. And so there's things I just kind of push off. You know, I'm a procrastinator, I guess. And I go, I don't know, how am I going to therapy, like when do I have time for that? Or, you know, how would I possibly work that into my life? And I'm open to it and I would be interested in it. I did go, you know, 10 years ago or so, I was stabbed. I don't know if you know this story. I was stabbed in the back. And it's a long story that you could read about online if you're interested, but it was short story is a random act of violence, wrong place, wrong time, stabbed by a drug-fueled neighbor.
More about that in a moment.
Hello, I'm a stuffy dowager countess.
Travis?
I'm judging everybody's manners.
Oh, no.
Schmanners isn't judgy. It's about teaching you to be your best self and be a little more confident when you enter social situations that you don't understand, and maybe also teach you a little bit about history you didn't know or give you interesting things to talk about at parties.
Yeah, like the secret life of Emily Post.
Or like why wristwatches are the way that they are.
We can talk about table manners from the Victorian era.
Sure, or what it's like to attend a Regency ball.
Yeah.
You can find all that and more if you listen to Schmanners on Maximum Fun or wherever your podcasts come from, I guess.
Manners, Schmanners. Get it?
A man goes to the doctor and says that he's depressed and that life seems cruel. The doctor says, the treatment is simple. The great clown Pagliacci is in town tonight. Go and see him, and you will surely feel better. The man bursts into tears and says, "But doctor, I am Pagliacci." Okay, says the doctor. In which case, try listening to the Beef and Dairy Network podcast. The Beef and Dairy Network podcast is a multi-award-winning comedy podcast, and you can find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with Tim Heidecker, he was talking about being stabbed by a neighbor who was on drugs.
you know, I definitely had PTSD after that and went to a therapist and didn't click at the time. She wasn't right for me or whatever. I felt uncomfortable talking and then did that thing, which is the thing of like cancer, you know, I started just kind of finding excuses not to go and then dropped it, you know? So, and I think I do that all in all sorts of other ways with like, you know, I did meditation for a while and then dropped it, or did yoga for a while and dropped it. But, you know, now I'm on like kind of a routine in my life where I walk and jog, and that becomes kind of my time to like process things or work things out in my head.
Do you think that the incident with the stabbing is still with you psychologically?
Not so much. No, I don't. It feels very, I think the therapy of that experience was, how I kind of closed that experience was I, you know, was given the opportunity to forgive that person and to, he was a college kid who I knew who had gotten into, I guess, essentially like bath salts, you know, or some, I don't know exactly what, but it was like one of those things where it was so, so not him when that happened. And I didn't testify or press charges or whatever the legal course would have been to lock him up. But there was there were charges that he had to deal with because it was a crime. It wasn't, but I made it as easy as possible for him to not get caught up in the system of the prison system or anything. So, you know, I felt like that closure of that experience was like, all right, this was a random thing that happened. It wasn't anything I did. It really wasn't even anything he did. It was a chemical imbalance that was caused by these insane drugs. And so it kind of like there was a logic to the whole thing. It made sense. There's no long-term effects of it. I got a good story out of it. I got, you know, some cool scars and I can move on. But I don't know. There could be unexamined things there. I do have, you know, I think if there's one thing in my life that I'd like to fix permanently is I have a fairly healthy sized fear of heights that is definitely prohibits me from doing some things in my life where I'm like, this is just fucking stupid. But now, you know, I was at this movie theater the other night that was in LA, and it was on the third floor of this complex of this, it's the Alamo Draft House if you're in LA. And there's like a three-story staircase that if you go down the staircase, it looks like you're kind of walking into a bit of a void. Like the left you would take at the bottom of the first floor is kind of, it's just out over an open space. And I went to that top of this. I go, nope, I'm going elevator, you know? And so like, I'm like changing behavior because of this stupid thing. And I don't know exactly what that's about. And I'm sure that some kind of therapy or medication could perhaps absolve me of that feeling.
Do you don't know where it came from?
I know where it started. I know enough about it where it's that the feeling of like, oh my God, I could jump. And I think it's called the fear of the void or something like that.
Yeah. Like what if I made this crazy decision out of nowhere to do this?
Yeah. And that's the thought. And then that kind of keeps, I can't get that thought out of my head when I'm around basically a railing that's up high. That's like, you know, obviously not obviously, but I don't have issues on planes. Any, you know, if I'm in a gondola, like going up a mountain, I really don't have an issue there as I'm often on,
you know, your standard gondola commute. Trip. Yeah.
But I was walking across like 10 or so years ago, you know, and this was post stabbing. So who knows, but walking across the Golden Gate Bridge with the family and suddenly just like, holy shit, I got to sit down. Like, I can't be here. I can't be here. I have to. And I kind of had, you know, like a panic attack and had to have my wife kind of like hold my hand across the rest of the bridge. And so, I don't remember it from before that, but there's something that's hit me in my mid-30s that just hit hard. Wow. And I've met fair enough people that have that same feeling. That so I know it's a thing. It's definitely a thing. So
yeah, but you have no idea if it's connected to the incident with the stabbing.
No,
yeah.
I don't
know either. That's a tough one.
Yeah,
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the music and the latest album especially, because it has a lot. I mean, it's about adolescence, and it's about, there's this sense in a lot of the songs of, you know, things might work out for me or things might work out for others, but there's a good chance they won't.
Interesting.
And I know that you're from Allentown, Pennsylvania, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's sort of this middle class sensibility that I feel like you don't hear of a lot. Like you hear music about being very successful. You hear music about being at the rock bottom and you know, nothing's safe in your life. But this sort of ambivalent middle class of this could go either way isn't explored a whole lot.
Well, yeah, I guess somebody that did it really well was Bruce Springsteen, because I think a lot of his early, you know, 10-year, his first few albums are about growing up and getting out and succeeding and leaving behind this middle class, working class, you know, very black and white or gray kind of life. All is Born to Run and Thunder Road and all those songs are just about like getting out. And what his vision of success was as a teenager was like becoming a rock star, which is what he got to do. As I was thinking about those years and how I'm lucky that I got to, that I had art and music and film and comedy as a place to go, as a dream to have. And I was lucky enough to get to do it. And I'm still lucky. I feel lucky that I get to do this. I think about my friends, the kids who were my friends then, who didn't get out. And some of them didn't make it. You know, one of them died shortly after college. And he was very talented, but also did, you know, drugs and got into heroin and overdosed, you know, 21 years old. Like, wasn't a junkie, just kind of took one too many bumps of something that he shouldn't have, and that was it, you know. And the residual effects of that, and how that, the other, as I picture me, Phil was his name, and my cousin Joel, who is who we were in a band together, and we tried, you know, we were very close and made music together, but also just hung out and drank and smoked weed and listened to music and went to movies together and, you know, became, you know, grew up, learned how to be adults together, you know, died last year from years and years of drinking. And, you know, he's my age, my cousin. And out of me, him and Joel, me, Phil and Joel, I'm here. For whatever reason, maybe partly because I had these valves, I had these ways of expression, these ways of being creative. But I just think about the idea that even for people that had it pretty easy, life is still really hard. You know, like it's a fucking grind, and it's, and obviously there are people that are not in the creative arts. There are people that have extremely happy and balanced lives. You know, there's lots of ways to be. For me, at least, though, like to have the outlet to express myself in comedy and music, and has been a lifesaver. And I think about in the song Buddy, there's a few different people going on there in my head, but I was thinking about Joel and Phil and a couple other people, one of whom I could picture just doing bong hits in his bedroom, listening to Rage Against the Machine, and thinking, where is this guy going? You know, like, where is this going to, you know, how is he going to be happy? You know, what is going to make him satisfied in his adult life? And I think, guy, it's really hard on guys. We obviously, it's hard on everybody, believe me. Like, I don't want to make us sound like, you know, I don't know. It feels dumb to say that white guys have it hard, you know, but it's worth acknowledging that, like I said, even for people that have it easy, life can be really hard. And guys turn to drinks and drugs and, you know, all kinds of distractions to get through it.
I think it's a societal thing too, and especially back when you were that age, like I think there's more openness among kids of all stripes today about what's going on with their mental health and what's going on in the world. And for guys back then, there was certainly a man up kind of concept around there. And I think a lot of young people, certainly in my kind of working class suburb I grew up in, a lot of guys dealt with that by getting really stoned.
Yeah. You know? No, that's right. It was
or just driving around in the Camaro and not going anywhere.
No, you're right. And now I'm sure it's much different. And you can, I mean, there seems to be a tremendous drug problem now as well, but there must be better ways to help and deal with people that have legitimate or serious mental illness, but also just general anxiety and depression about that is, you know, just based on the world around them at the moment, you know. So I was getting high and drinking a lot in high school too, but I also had theater and I had the local public radio station that I got to work at for a little bit or the college radio station. And I had outlets that weren't just about sitting in the woods with a case of, you know, warm beer.
Did it just now occurs to me, did Billy Joel kind of do a number on the mental health in Allentown because of that song? Did that mess people up?
There was a little bit of a chip on our shoulder about that song.
Think.
And a little bit of like, excuse me? What are you saying about it? You know, right. And the joke was kind of like, well, you should be singing that about Bethlehem, because Bethlehem was the sister city where Bethlehem Steel was.
Yeah.
And so the song was really about people from Bethlehem. But Allentown, I guess, sounded better.
It scanned better. Yeah, I heard that. Yeah. It was originally Bethlehem.
Yeah.
Yeah, poor Allentown. I mean, that's all I've ever known about Allentown for most of my life.
Well, I sang about, there's a song I do on my album from called What the Brokenhearted Do about going back to Allentown for a funeral, another cheery song. But yeah, I say this place that Billy Joel sang about means nothing to me anymore. Only a memory, just a pile of rubble and rust. And I was like, that's not going to, and I remember my mom being like, that's not very nice. You know, like, come on, it's not that bad. I'm like, come on. But that sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's like it kind of melded Bruce Springsteen and Billy Joel into
exactly.
into one concept. But do you have a thing though, where if other people are making fun of Allentown, that's not okay?
No, I don't. I couldn't wait to get out. I don't. Yeah. I haven't been back in a while, but I always look at it. I was like, man, this place could be cool. Like it's really pretty in parts. It's very rural. There's lots of hills and agricultural, you know, farmland, and it's close to New York. It's close to Philly. I was like, this could be like Portland or something. You know, it could be this like artist enclave kind of cool. Small town or like medium, it's, you know, it's not a small town. It's a fairly big city or I guess it's a small city as opposed to a small town, but, the fucking people, you know, like it's this Pennsylvania and I'm one of them. It's like this Pennsylvania Dutch kind of grumpy Germanic kind of, you know, unhealthy, unexamined, conservative leaning type of people make it quite unpleasant, you know. It makes it like not a fun group of people to hang with.
That would be a really interesting commercial for the Allentown Tourism Board. Tim Heidecker for Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Right. Well, it's like Bruce sang in that, like there was that joke about Bruce, about Born to Run being the state anthem of New Jersey. And then right. The lyrics are, baby, this town rips the bones from your back. It's a death trap, a suicide rap. It's like, no.
Yeah, well, and in his that Broadway show, the one-man show he did, he explains that he currently lives about 10 miles from the town that he grew up
right,
in.
Right,
right. He went out, but he didn't get very far.
No.
Well, it's funny, too, like with the comedy you do and with, you know, the stuff that you do with Eric Wareheim, there was always, I remember watching it when I first started watching it, it was kind of scary to me.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know where you were going with it. I didn't know who you guys actually were. Like, you didn't do that kind of opening monologue where it's clear that you're just two nice guys.
Right.
You know, it just got weird and there was no formula to it that I could discern. Like, with a regular comedy sketch, you kind of, you get the arc of it pretty easily. And there was a lot of anarchy to what you've done.
Yeah, I don't argue with any of that. I think there. If you look back on it now, I think you'll probably see more of a formula or more of a. There's more of a plan there that might reveal itself the more you watch. Yeah, but we were just we were young. We loved Mr. Show and the Kids in the Hall. What we didn't love was sort of the structure of comedy and sort of the rules of comedy of. The big example being like Saturday Night Live, having the cool blues rock band playing the intro.
G.E. Smith. Yeah.
G.E. Smith and being like, okay, now like we're cool.
Yeah.
But here's the comedy,
Right.
Just so you know, like we're just fun loving guys. Like we wanted to make strange, weird, uncomfortable comedy because that's what made us laugh. We made each other laugh doing that. And we never, it was weird just to not think about how the audience would think about it. We were just like, somebody else thought it was funny. And that was the person at Adult Swim, Mike Lazo, and a few people. They thought it was funny. And we didn't think about it being like intentionally disorienting or alienating. We just like, sort of like I was saying with the opera bit, like I'm making it for my audience. I'm making it for myself. I'm not thinking about if it doesn't work for you. I would just assume if it doesn't work for you, you wouldn't care or
you wouldn't
watch.
Stick around. Yeah.
Yeah, you wouldn't stick around. So.
It's funny that my own kids, every family kind of has running bits that they do.
Yeah.
In my family, one of the running bits is the do-do-do-do song, the think about your dad, what's your dad like? I want to meet that dad.
Yeah.
My kids just latched onto that one, and that's been a running gag for years in our house. I'll just jump in here to play a bit of the clip I'm talking about from Tim and Eric. Awesome show. Great job.
Do-do-do-do. Feather your bangs. Shake your buns. That's nice. Now think about your dad. What's your dad like? I want to meet that dad.
Okay, back to the interview.
Well, it's funny. It's like that's just a silly, stupid idea that we struck upon as we're hanging out, just like, what if it's like this Barry White style or like a soul singer guy who's just really obsessed with dads? All right, funny, right? It's just a funny, stupid idea. And then you extrapolate that and you find out that he's into meat. It's all absurd and stuff like you're laughing. It's just the stuff you say in a room with comedy people that make each other laugh. And then you see it through. But then, years later, it's still around and it lingers. And we were dealing with, as the Q conspiracy came up, we started getting like attached to that our shows there was pedophilic references in the show because of that stuff. And it's just like, if you could only see how this stuff begins and how it really is just these, guys eating chips, making each other laugh about the absurdity of the character, not any kind of sexual thing with children. And it's just, it's just crazy.
But then I also have noticed that some of the acting you've done, I stick around, like I lean in a little closer when you're on screen because part of me is expecting the unexpected. Part of me is something expecting some kind of swerve.
I don't project. Is that why you're leaning? You have to turn the volume up.
No, you project just fine. I'm leaning in for the kind of absurdist punchline, even when you're playing a perfectly normal person. Like in Our Flag Means Death, I'm like, oh, what's Tim gonna do? Oh. It turns out he's gonna be very nice to everybody.
Yeah, I was interested in that. I was like, oh, this is fun. I get, because I do sometimes get typecast as kind of a jerk or an asshole character, and I am always looking for parts. Not that I have a big pile of offers in front of me, but it's always interesting when something comes like, oh, I could do that. I'm a nice guy. Because the first thing Eric and I ever did was Tom Goes to the Mayor, and my character on that show is kind of this hapless, nice idiot who is, you know, always kind of the butt of the joke. And I loved doing that too. But then I sort of, in Awesome Show, I started playing kind of jerks, and that became fun too. And I play a massive asshole throughout the On Cinema universe, but
right.
And my stand-up character's an asshole. And but it is fun to like just play kind of a nice guy, and I'm always open to that. Maybe not as fun, I should say, because it's fun to be the jerk. It's really fun to be the jerk, but I'm capable of being sort of a normal person.
Tim Heidecker, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. That was great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. That's Tim Heidecker. His latest album is called High School. One more clip. This is from an episode of Wits, the comedy variety show that I hosted. We did a version of It's Cold Outside called There's Mummies Outside. John Munson and Janie Winterbauer on vocals, Amy Mann on bass, me and Tim as zombie mummies. Enjoy.
The neighbors might think,
I know what's going on here.
Say, what's in this drink?
The Egyptian amulet I stole.
I wish I knew how.
From the museum
to
downtown.
Break this spell.
A spell, that's it. I unleashed an evil spell.
I ought to say no.
Are you
no.
even hearing what I say?
At least I'm gonna say that
the
I tried.
The scenario is much worse than
really
you think.
Can't stay.
We're under undead attack.
Oh,
there's mummies outside.
Next time on Depression Mode.
Seeking approval is so essentially human. Some of the most meaningful, embarrassing, wonderful, soul-stretching things I've ever done have been in the name of wanting to be seen and heard and loved. And I wanted to suggest to others that being honest about seeking approval is, that's not a sin. It's not something you need to fix. It is something to investigate to see from whom you want approval and why and when.
From Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, actor and author Faith Saley is with us. If people support our show, we can have a show. If people don't or they stop, then there won't be a show. I like making a show. I think you like listening to it. Please support our show. It's easy to do. If you haven't done so already, go to MaximumFun.org/join. Be sure to hit subscribe and write reviews. Give us 5 stars on all those podcasting platforms. That helps more people learn about the show. That helps more conversations about mental health happen. And that's why we make the show. Please know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free. 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text the word HOME to 741-741. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. We'd love to hear from you, your thoughts, your comments, your criticisms, your compliments, and anything else, your fashion tips. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our newsletter, Depression Mode Newsletter, is on Substack. I write it, comes out twice a week. It's free. Search it up. I'm on Twitter at John Moe.
Hi, Credits listeners. I record things in my house, on the western side of my house, right next to my neighbor who has her air conditioner on the east side of her house. So now I find myself hoping for cool days to avoid the loud rattle of her AC. I like warm days in the summer, though, especially after a Minnesota winter, and so I am conflicted. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, this is Emily from Planet Earth, and I'm here to tell you to be who you are, because you are pretty great.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.